Hello, and welcome back to another episode of You Can Survive, Let's Talk About Cancer. I'm your host, Arzu, a cancer survivor, as well as cancer champion for the patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. I'm also part of the Cancer Smart Initiative, which is an exciting opportunity to help tackle cancer and its associated inequalities in West Yorkshire and Harrogate. In particular, we're looking at how we can help improve outcomes of cancer patients through early diagnosis and screening and provision of preventative advice. On today's episode, I'm joined by Rob, who is a fellow cancer champion. Would you like to say hi to the listeners, Rob?
Hi, everyone.
And today we both have the pleasure of interviewing an incredible person who's experienced cancer in a number of different ways. He's seen cancer in his family. He's also seen cancer within his local community through his work as a GP previously. And he's recently been diagnosed with cancer himself. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Stuart.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to have you join us today. I'm really excited to speak to you.
Thank you.
So would you like to start off by telling the listeners a bit more about yourself and maybe your journey with cancer so far?
I qualified as a doctor in London in 1973, but my involvement with cancer started before that. When I was 13 years old, my best friend was diagnosed with leukemia. We were playing rugby. When he came off the rugby field, he was covered in bruises. He ended up in hospital, and within 6 weeks, he passed away because there was no treatment for leukemia then. That was one of the defining moments of my life because up to that point, I'd been quite religious. You know, I'm Jewish, which will come out later in the talks. But I went and prayed for him every week at the synagogue, but he passed away. And that kind of altered my attitude to religion until later in my life. So I went away to medical school. At medical school, you know, palliative care is something that is not taught, or it wasn't taught when I went to medical school. It is now. But I came across cancer in a lot of different instances. It's a time when there wasn't the treatment that there is now. So often patients in different wards that were on had cancer. And I think sometimes some experiences come back to you from then. I think one of them was when I was on call as a doctor. He covered the whole hospital. And I remember there was a guy of about 27, had no family or no friends, and he was basically in the last stage of cancer. And they asked me to sit with him, and I sat with him and held his hand till he passed away. And that was, these sorts of things had a great influence on my life. Anyway, I came back home after I'd qualified. I went to be a GP. I did a year training in Hemsworth in South Yorkshire. Then I spent nearly 40 years as a GP in the Leeds area. And my last 36 years was as a GP in Beeston, which was an area that had a lot of Muslim patients, but a lot of different ethnic groups. And when you're a GP, certain instances of looking after people come back to you. And some of them I can even see now. I remember, you remember the sad case. I remember a girl who was Russian, who was studying at the university, who unfortunately developed stomach cancer, and she was only 34. And what transpired was that she was born downwind from Chernobyl, and Chernobyl, with all the radiation, had led to a stomach cancer. And it was very sad. I remember her mother coming over here, and I remember they were Russian Orthodox, and I remember sitting with them for, you know, most of an evening till she passed away with the candles, and they were saying prayers. So these things do stick with, all things that made a difference to my life. I retired in 2012, but before that, my father had had stomach cancer. And when you're a doctor and you can't make your patients better, that's difficult. When you're a doctor and you can't make your family better, it's really a lot worse. And I remember my father had stomach cancer. It was inoperable. We went to see the consultant for some chemotherapy. He had one lot of chemotherapy, which didn't help. And then when we went back, the specialist said, "I can't do anything more for you, Mr. Manning." So I went back with my father and we sat at home, and he said, the most difficult thing that's ever been said to me in my life. He said, "Stuart, you're a doctor. I've got a lot of money. What are we going to do?" And the answer is, couldn't do anything. And that stuck with me. And then 10 years later, my mother had dementia and breast cancer. And she had fungating breast cancer, which is awful. And the thing is, you know, you sat there with your mother and you just can't do anything. You know, and I watched her pass away, basically. And it led to me, you know, it led to me getting burnt out, and I had a period of time off work. And when I talk about my journey with cancer, when my mother passed away, it was a relief. You know, it was a relief. She was suffering. And I remember I went to the hospital. I held her hand while she passed away. And my mind cleared. And 2 weeks later, my burnout had gone. But that basically altered my attitude to life. And so I retired. I started working for a friend of mine has a charity. It mainly deals with motor neuron disease. His son died at 35 of motor neuron disease. But basically, the charity provides financial help to young families. So I started working with them as a goodwill ambassador. I'm not on the committee. I don't like committees generally, but I work with them as a goodwill ambassador. And through that, I went to St. Gemma's. I went to Wheatfields, went to these other places, and I became involved with people going through the cancer journey. One thing that I'm quite proud of is my brother and I have set up these funds at the hospices. They're only small funds, but they're emergency funds. So at Wheatfields, at St. Gemma's, and also at Martin House, we've set up small funds which are for emergencies. So basically, you know, there's some petty cash there that if they need to get a taxi, an emergency can do that. And so, yeah, I think I'm passionate about helping people, putting something back, which is why, basically, you know, I relented and agreed to become a trustee of the charity. But, I don't like committees. I'm better off working by myself. I mean, I've done other things. As I've said in the past, I'm quite proud of the fact that I met a lady with motor neuron disease through my work, and I managed by myself to put on a wedding for her. All the supplies and everything. So I like a challenge, but when I work and do things, it's why I'm quite excited about working with you. I like an end point. I like to be able to see what I'm doing. I'm not very good at nebulous discussions and guidelines and things like that, but, you know, but working with you on this project, I'm really excited about it. So that's my answer for the first question.
Thank you so much. I mean, I think one point I really want to touch upon is how you talked about your mother and how she reached the end of her life, and you felt a sense of relief when she eventually passed away because she was suffering. And, you know, when we think about cancer, a lot of people, you know, fear death and the end. And I think, you know, with our podcast, the You Can Survive series, we're not just talking about surviving cancer as in, no evidence of disease. It's more about even reaching the end point, which is death eventually for some people, and realizing that it's not all dark. It's still got a lot of positivity in it. There's that reduction in suffering eventually. And finally, that cancer really, you know, consumes an entire family. I mean, for yourself, it was your friend and then your parents that really influenced the way you thought about cancer and what you wanted to do within the community and the kind of difference that you wanted to see. So, you know, I'm really glad that you shared with us your journey so far. And we look forward to asking you some more questions, specifically, you know, talking about ethnic minorities. And you said earlier that you dealt with a lot of patients from these particular groups.
Basically, I had a small practice, but there was probably 5,000 patients, but over 1,000 Muslim patients. Who never met anybody Jewish, which is kind of strange, you know. And it was a journey for me, and it was interesting because this is what I don't like about the situation where the Jews don't get on with the Muslims, etc. We're the same people, and basically the Muslims and the Jews must have all been out in the desert together years ago, and they believe in exactly the same things that we do. So when a Muslim patient dies, they like to have the funeral the next day. So I always made myself available to do that. And it was interesting, you know, and it built up a real relationship. When I retired, I got fantastic letters from the local Muslim patients. And interestingly, because they knew I was Jewish, they used to bring me food in, but make sure it was kosher. You know what I mean? Mm. So they didn't put any pork or anything in it. But it was also, it's a language problem as well. I mean, it's very difficult to get over messages when you're doing it through an interpreter. It's very, very difficult. And also, as a male or white male, there is a kind of barrier there. And also, when people are wearing the hijab and things like, you can't see people's reactions. And when you're giving people bad news, if you like, or trying to assess the reaction, you can't assess it behind that. And that is a real barrier. Also, we've discussed about before, is that different racial groups may have problems with some of the things leading to diagnosis of cancer. You know, like there's not just, most men are not very keen to have the rectal examination for prostate cancer. You know, and also, to be honest, a lot of Muslim people are even, you know, more wary of it. It's like, I don't know how you popularise that or get people to be interested in it. And it's difficult. And I think a lot of women who go for breast screening, it's difficult. But the thing as well is that when you're giving bad news to people, you do need to be able to see their reaction. So, you know, you talk to somebody in the practice and you have the family there and you say, I'm really sorry to tell you, but the investigations have come back and it says you may have ovarian cancer. But the person who has the problem is talking to you through an interpreter, and it's very, very difficult to understand. One of the things that immediately need to assess as a doctor is how much information people want when they talk to you and how to pass on that information. And, you know, I think I've said perhaps before, it's very, very difficult. You know, you give people bland figures, and we've discussed things like you're saying to somebody, and they say to you, well, you know, how long do you think my mother will survive with this? And you talk about 5-year survival rates, and it's very difficult to get that over. And also, if you want to explain to people what, you know, what the journey may be, and they say, what are the options? It's a very, very long, difficult process going through an interpreter when you're doing that, which is a daughter or whatever. And I think that is one of the major things that I came up against, basically. I mean, in terms of, I think another instance, which is analogous to this, is after I retired, I became involved with a Jewish group, which is they're called Brekker Journey. And they're the people who basically popularised the genetic screening for the BRCA gene. You know, Jewish women, which is sort of Ashkenazi, which are Jewish women from the far, from, you know, from Eastern Europe, and also a lot of Polish women have this gene. And the thing about this gene is that it's very important now to be able to find out if you have it or not. So what we did was, it was set up by a lady who lost her mother through breast cancer, and she set up this BRCA gene, and they're there to counsel people. Because it's, you know, it's difficult, you know, when you're talking to people or young women of 40 and saying, you know, you need to have a bilateral mastectomy and your ovaries removed. So one of the things that you're going to come on to is, how do you actually help or target ethnic minorities? You have to go right to the roots of where they are. So what we did was, we had, I think there's a National Cancer Weekend, I'm not really sure, but in February, 3 years running, we had a meeting at the end of the service. So on the Saturday, we had a meeting in the synagogue, and we talked about it, because the ramifications, you know, if you have breast cancer, the ramifications, if you have this gene, are massive, because there's a massive increase in incidence of pancreatic cancer. There's an increase possibly in melanoma. I don't know, but it's quite a major thing to get people to buy into, because then if they say, I have the screening, they're then faced, if they have the gene, in perhaps having to tell, you know, got two young daughters, and telling the daughters at some point. But to do it, you have to go right to the roots to do it. And I think the thing is that I built a very good relationship with my community. It took a long time, you know, and there weren't that many people. I mean, the big problem with practices now is that they're massive. You know, I knew everybody in the practice, and basically it is difficult. You know, I knew the people, and by the end of it, you know, I had a fantastic relationship with the people, but it takes time. And I think that the other thing that probably, you talk about ethnic communities, if you take some of the places in Yorkshire like Bradford and Dewsbury, at the time, they were, the ethnic communities had ethnic doctors. So there were small practices. There was a lot of single-handed doctors in Bradford and Dewsbury. So the patients identified with the people there. But a lot of these doctors have now retired. There's not a lot of them coming through. So the big practices, and the people can feel isolated from them. So again, it's how do you go out there and actually mix with the people and get the ethnic minorities to buy into what you're doing. I think I've said before to people, you know, you may have to go, if you look at dealing with ethnic minorities, particular groups of people, I always feel that you have to get somebody from the particular minority to help you engage with the people.
There's got to be more to it than languages and reactions. There's got, you know, we could talk about that at length all the time, couldn't we? But there's got to be a way to address people in, rather than through an interpreter. I appreciate there needs to be an interpreter if people don't understand, but there's got to be a way of dealing with them as people. And I've read what you said. I mean, I've chatted with you, Stuart, on numerous occasions at the trustees groups and stuff, and I know what you've done, and I've read the articles of all the various things you've done over your career and beyond and before and after. But from your experience, other than a language barrier and everything else, there's got to be something within each community that obstructs people from seeking the support. And that's what we're trying to look at, is how do we bring people into that? And I think you might have touched on it by the local doctor being a thing of the past. You know, the local GP in that area would have had an easier job than a GP in a large surgery. And is there a way that you think, from your experience, that that level of contact can be put back into the larger practices, so to speak?
I think you can do it. I think it takes time. You have to find somebody who is relevant to the community. I think it is. I mean, like I said, it's very difficult if you're going out as a white male doctor to talk to some ethnic community about breast cancer and things like that. I think one of the ways that I've said before, when you and I have discussed this, is called the Jade Goody effect. You have to try and find somebody who the community look up to, you know, somebody like on the slide, people look up to, you know, like to Rashford, the footballer. You have to find somebody in the community. It's like with prostate cancer, as you're aware, you know, there's been a lot of the footballers got involved with that, or like testicular cancer. You need somebody of those communities to put the head above the parapet and help you in that way. It's very, very difficult otherwise. You know, I mean, I'm happy to talk to anybody, but you don't get a lot of response from some of the people because they don't necessarily, not don't respect you. You have nothing in common with them. You have nothing really in common. So you say, how do you do it? I mean, sometimes, as I said, you may have to, I don't know whether certain people go to the mosque. I don't really know. And it's not just black communities or Asian communities. There's a lot of different communities that we don't integrate with because, you know, the situation now is completely different from to when I started work. You know, to when I started work. I think that one way might be, and it may be possible, I don't know, is we have a lot more certain foreign GPs working here. Perhaps they could get involved with some of their communities in some instances. And I don't think it just has to be in a practice now. Because the practices form these bigger groups, etc., it may be one person in an area. Or, you know, like a cancer champion or like a lead cancer doctor who may
be. This is one of the things I've thought about, because I think about this all the time. And I was talking to Azu when we were discussing yourself. And when you referenced your friend when you were at school, I was telling you, know what? I can truly get that. When I was, well, he was 10, coming up to 11, just before we started secondary school, my closest friend, a lad called Nigel Wright, we were 3 years on the trot, boys club, wheelbarrow race, runners up. But we were very, very close. And Nigel was an only child and he got leukemia. and we were a similar age, and it was a, it, there was, as you rightly said, there was, you got it, that was it, you were going. And he didn't even make the summer and second. So, and I, even now, all these years later, I still think of Nigel pretty much every day, and it does form how you're doing it. And one of the things I always think about is community nurses used to be something that was there. And surely there must be, well, what I'd like to know is what your thoughts are on a return to a community nurse for each practice. And it, not just a nurse, but a community-specific nurse within each practice. And they can be move within practices, so to speak. And then each community has that one nurse that sympathises with their origins, their ethnicity, and their requirements, and can take that a stage further. Because as you rightly say, we don't have, each of us has everything in common, and some days we also have nothing in common. And it's hard to break that down. We all have to live together, and we all should live together. But it's just getting over those barriers of gender or religion or whatever else. Right. And it saddens. But if we could get your thoughts on that, that would be...
I mean, one thing I'd like to do, and I said this, you and I, and we all need to sit down and decide how we're going to get the message out there. We've created the message, but how are we going to get it out there? And that's something that I will help you with, and we'll talk about as we go along. It's difficult. I would like to. It's difficult because it works in different ways in different areas. I mean, if you look at an affluent area where I live, a lot of people have all the information that they need. It isn't one policy fits all, basically, which is why I would really like to engage with. I've been trying for a while with. There is a cancer lead in Leeds, a cancer lead GP. You know, I would like to talk to her and get some of her ideas. I remember a lot of the things that have been put into the community now do not come via the GP practices, but they come from a different sort of fund. So it's a matter of tackling that. And I think one way as well is, you know, like we said, is possibly having a bus that goes out there to different areas with people, you know, like, you know, we could have it in the centre of Leeds one day. You perhaps go to different areas like Middleton and Gipton, you have the people like that. And I think once you popularise it, I mean, I think one thing I would like to do is possibly, you know, use people like the Yorkshire Evening Post and people like that who have a wide readership. And it's also asking from them how some of the people feel that we can respond to them. We can have all the ideas that we want, but it's a matter of what do these people need from us to help them engage? I mean, it's a difficult situation. I mean, going back to your, you know, the people's cancer stories impact them for the rest of their life. I mean, I've always said, you know, that you, sadly, some of the people with cancer move on, they reach the end of the journey. But a lot of the work that I've done is to help the relatives and the rest of it, which is you know, doing things that help along the way. I mean, you talk about my first experience with cancer, and what made it even more poignant was this was in 1963, 30 years later, my daughter's best friend developed leukemia. And she, unfortunately, even though it was 30 years later, died of leukemia. Her father was a Leeds GP, so it brought all the nightmares back. But I think what we have to do is we have to try and help people along the way to enable them to get the information so that they know where to go. And different people want different things out of the system. I mean, like I said, I think that we need to go back to the days where there was an effective cancer champion or a cancer GP in each practice, somebody that you can actually contact along the way.
And like just touching upon this like idea of having like a champion to represent ethnic minority, I think that's a really great way to start opening up that communication between healthcare professionals and patients from the ethnic minorities. I mean, you know, I'm also a healthcare professional, so a lot of our training, we're told that you want to work in partnership with the patient to provide them with the care that they want. And that is tailored to their needs. So it's like, you know, for one patient, what they require from a doctor would be very different to another patient. And that's where the ethnic minorities come in. And, you know, their needs in terms of, for example, requiring an interpreter, for example, or any other culture competence that is necessary in the care that you provide is really important. So having maybe an intermediate champion to represent those groups is certainly a good idea, and maybe from the medical background so that they have that knowledge they need to be able to communicate with GPs, for example, in communities and other healthcare professionals, whether it's prescribers or nurses, to make sure that we're working towards the needs of the community. And you said, like, you know, in Bradford, in Dewsbury, and some of the areas in Leeds, there's a high population of ethnic minorities, and we want to make sure that we're making them feel like they're included, or that we understand them. And I think the barrier comes because of the fact that they don't know how much you know them or how well you know them and their needs. And I think vice versa, like, you feel that the patients don't realize that it's difficult for you as well because of those barriers. And it's that working together, maybe through an intermediate who understands both sides, the patients and the healthcare professionals, to be able to improve the quality of care you're providing. And I think the fact that you've had that personal experience with cancer really helps, because you realize how, when managing patients with cancer, whether they're newly diagnosed or at the end of life, it's very different to managing someone for a minor ailment, for example. You know, there's a whole family that is affected, there's finances that come in, social, you know, factors, and then cultural, you know, acceptance of a diagnosis can vary as well, because people respond differently. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about in season one was that stigma around cancer, and, like, within ethnic minorities in some groups, there may still be you know, that stigma that is preventing them maybe from accessing healthcare or certain services, and that could be contributing to those cancer inequalities. So I think it's nice to see a GP like yourself who has both the experience of cancer and then just that professional experience, and who is willing to, you know, step out and reach out to those communities and look for those solutions. So I think the champion work could potentially be a possible solution to the current, I'd say, challenge that we do face.
It is a big challenge. I mean, I have a thing with Matt Millen. I mean, as you know, guys, I do. I'm a cancer patient rep within Matt Millen, and it is plainly obvious when you go to the First Steps meetings and the health and wellbeing events that Matt Millen hold that the inequality is visual in who attends. And the number of people that go to these Macmillan meetings, and this is no disrespect to Macmillan, it's one of the things that they're driving to alter and change, that the ethnic minorities do not go to the cancer meetings that they hold. Very few attend, and it's trying to find a way to get the message that there is an inequality, and it's sad to see, but also that really, there doesn't need to be. And that's the message that needs to be also put across, is that everyone that gets cancer, gets cancer. We're all the same. It doesn't matter. Cancer is no judge of who you are and where you come from. As you said, you know, you can be the richest
cancer
man in the world.
Cancer doesn't discriminate.
Exactly. And therefore, everyone that gets it just needs to come forward. And trying to get that message across, it must be so hard.
I mean, a couple of things. In my career as a GP, the thing that people always remember you for is how you look after their families in terminal illness.
Yeah.
It's something that comes, I mean, I was building up to retiring, I went back to work for 6 months. I mean, I'd been off work, I was burnt out. My mum passing away cleared my mind, I went back to work. But the number of people came in and said, you know, I remember you visiting my dad 30 years ago, or... And the other thing about ethnic minorities that is very, very important, and I only thought about this the other day, is that a lot of ethnic minorities, particularly Asian families, live in big groups in one house. So the problem you have is that you might have 12, 14 people all in a house, all watching this one person who is passing away with cancer, and that leaves a really bad memory for a lot of people. And it's difficult to get around that. And not all people want to pass away in a hospice. And when you talk about the journey with cancer, I totally agree. It's trying to get through to people that there are different stages of it. And we often fail along the way. I persuaded a lady that I'd met through my charity work to go to a hospice, I won't say which one, and she wasn't very keen on going. She went there and they discussed it. And within 3/4 of an hour of her going to this hospice, the person doing all the notes said, "Have you decided where you'd like to end your days yet?" And 45 minutes into this. And then about half an hour later, they said, "You've got two daughters. We should be making memory books." And it's the only time in the 5 years I've ever known her that she rang up the phone and said, "What have you sent me to?" But we don't think about all of that. The impact at the beginning, it goes back to this, you know, I mean, I'll tell you my personal experience in a minute, but it goes back to the fact is that everybody's journey is going to be different. But you do have to try and set out to people what may or may not happen at the beginning. You know, so basically some people need chemo, some people need observing, some people need radiotherapy. The other thing that I always try to get over to people, and again, it's a language problem, is saying to people, a diagnosis of cancer doesn't necessarily mean that you're terminally ill. You know, and then trying to get over to people what you can do that's positive in that time, what you can do. And I mean, you talk about my experience. My experience is that about 18 months ago, I had a blood test and I was found to have abnormal white cells. Mm. Not a big deal, but they're going to monitor you. And they said to me at the time, you have a 1% chance a year of developing chronic lymphatic leukemia. Had a blood test in January. Out of the blue, I got a letter that said, "Dear Dr. Manning, because your white cells have stayed at this level for over a year, you are now classified as having chronic lymphatic leukemia." I mean, that was sent to me in a letter. And when you talk about my experience with cancer, I'm not belittling it, but it's not anything that, you know, that I'm desperately worried about. But the fact that that letter means that I struggle now with getting travel insurance and things like that, but I'm not ill and my condition hasn't changed. But it's not acceptable to get something like that in a letter, is it? I mean, it's all these different aspects of it. So that sort of impacts, I mean, that's partly where, you know, my story is at the moment, is that I'm well, but I'm passionate about putting something back. And you don't have to do a lot to make a difference. I mean, just the thing about cancer inequality that comes over is, as well, is the, you can see, if you go to some of the hospices in Leeds, the St Gemma's, which is done really well financially, there's Wheatfields, which is not done as well. And we went to the hospice in Bradford, and they're just so short of money, and it's sad. Things that, you know, we set up the fund. We're going back to Bradford. We're supposed to be going back with my brother. We haven't been able to go because of the pandemic. But, you know, they said to us when we're there, you know, we struggled to get £50 to hire a wedding dress for somebody who was terminally ill. So, you know, that to me, I can't really get my head around that. So that's why we'll set up a fund for things like that. So it's small differences like that.
It does make a big difference, doesn't it? I mean, I know what you're saying with the letter. I remember you telling me, and it just makes me shake my head. I mean, I remember when I was told, and part of me thinks, is there a good way of ever being told? I was told, I went in for a biopsy, an hour, I said. I was under anaesthetic for 4 hours and ended up staying in hospital for a week. And on the Thursday, they just said, "Can we have a word?" And I went, "Well, I'm captive audience, so." "Do you need to get anyone here?" I'm going, "Well, it's 11 o'clock in the morning. How am I going to get anyone here? You know, we're all here." And they just went, "Oh, it's, you know, that's Arcocell carcinoma on you." Well, cards, bang. And the point I want to get to, it wasn't the best place. It was in a room that somebody had sadly just died before, the day before. It wasn't a wonderful experience. But I just want to nip back to, you know, how people are told anything else and people's thoughts, processing anything else. I think nearly everybody has the same thought at that one moment of when you're told, and that is that you're going to die. This is what's going to see me off. And it isn't the case. And that's one of the other messages that needs to go to every community.
And just like to add on to both of your stories of how you were diagnosed,
Like with myself, I actually received my diagnosis like twice, because the first time I had my biopsy, my surgeon was so confident that he came to visit me and my family in the ward like 5 hours after my biopsy to confirm the diagnosis, even before he'd received the like report from the sort of analysis of the biopsy tissue. And instead of like the 1% that they told you, Stuart, I was told that he's 99% sure it was osteosarcoma. So, you know, he was very confident, and that was very brutal for 13-year-old me. Like, I was not expecting even a tumor in my leg because I had no clue what a biopsy is. So you can imagine how scary that was. However, my second experience, which was when I received the confirmed biopsy results, I just want to sort of emphasize how great my oncologist was with providing us with a room, getting all my family gathered together with me, and then breaking the news in a very compassionate manner. And I think as a South Asian, I really want to emphasize, like from the perspective of ethnic minorities, how important it is for us to have our entire family included, if that is our preference, because like I said, I think for anyone really, cancer consumes the entire family, but especially for South Asians like myself, we really appreciate the efforts healthcare professionals put into both looking after us, but our families, because it affects them equally or even more so because of how involved we are in one another's lives. And like you mentioned earlier, how you went to visit a patient at home and they had like 14, 15 people within the household, all seeing this patient pass away, basically. However, I think I can add to that from their perspective. And I'd say that for them, those probably were the most precious moments of their lives, because those were the last few minutes, hours, or days, for example, they were spending with that loved one. And I think, just like we mentioned earlier, it's all about, you know, opening up our awareness, both as, you know, healthcare professionals, members of the community, to the requirements of these groups. And then from the other perspective, for the ethnic minorities to realize that you're there to help them, you're there to support them, like Macmillan support as well, and that they shouldn't have any fear or hesitancy in accessing that help that is there for them specifically.
I think you're right. I mean, what you said earlier, well, what you've just said, to reiterate that, has been, and what Stuart was just saying there about his friend going to the hospice. You know, it's so vital to deal with people in a humane way. And with hospices do a lot of great work, but most people, particularly, like you say, South Asian people and family community related people, don't want to be in hospice, and they don't need to be in hospice.
Yeah.
It's vital, as you said, the quality, end of life quality, and quality of life during treatment. You need to be, the message needs to be across that that's how you can be, that's what you want, that's how it can go.
I think it's the balance. I mean, as a doctor, you really have to be guided by your initial consultation with the person, which goes back, you know, some people want to know a lot, some people don't. And it's striking a balance. I remember in my younger days as a GP, not being explain to people as much as I knew later in my career, not telling them exactly what the condition meant, because you know, some people may want to know the severity, or there may be something they want to do. I'm not, you know, you have to, you know, you have to strike a balance, but you always have to strike a positive. What I always try to do with people say to me, well, how long do you think I'm going to live for? I said, I don't know that, but let's not worry about that today. And what I tried to do is, you know, if they were perhaps in remission or whatever, is get them to focus on a certain event and think about that. You know, not worry about what's going to happen in 10 years' time, but say,
yeah.
I mean, I think a story that is an interesting story they like is, I had this patient who was 55, really nice guy, who had terminal kidney disease. And it was not long before I retired, and he came in to see me, and he was starting to deteriorate. And he says, Doc, he says, I want to have a special event before I go. So I said, what's that? So he said, basically, I want to renew my vows. He said, and you have contacts with Leeds United. I want to go to the ground, then I want to have a party. So what we did was, he renewed his vows. I managed to get in the tour of Leeds United. We upped his dose of drugs to the state where he could go and have his last party, wherever it was. And he passed away in Wheatfields a week later. And that to me is a fantastic story of what can be done. And it's you can't be positive in every aspect of cancer, but the thing is that treatments are getting better. It's the same. Yeah. If I go back to this lady who went to the hospice and was given, you know, where do you want to start? I mean, she was told 5 years ago that she had stage 4 breast cancer and would live probably not 18 months. She's still here because now she's on a new trial. And I think you have to say to people, this is difficult. This is the treatment. Some of it may not be pleasant, but, you know, but there may well be treatments that come across. And, you know, and it's a matter of striking this balance, which is not always easy, but it goes back to the initial consultation. You have to read how people are reacting to it and their relatives at the beginning. Mm. But I mean, going back, you should never be given a cancer diagnosis by yourself, whether it's in a letter or over the phone. I mean, interestingly, since I've become involved with the different aspects of cancer, et cetera, a friend of mine, again, he basically was lucky. He had an ultrasound on his spleen because he's got abnormal blood tests. And they found a kidney cancer. But he got the letter, he rang me on a Saturday afternoon and said, Stuart, yeah, because I've just got this letter in the post, yeah, I've got renal cancer. And I thought, on a Saturday, it's just not acceptable. Mm. And when you say to me, what do I want to change? I want to make a difference, but I want the things that make a difference, if you like, to be my legacy. So there's no excuse for things like that.
And that imagine getting that letter if English isn't your first language.
Exactly. That's what I was saying to you. That's the thing. If it isn't your first language or whatever, or you've nobody with you. I mean, I got the letter, but you know, I know that I have a diagnosis, and the odds are it's very unlikely to do me any harm. I said I've got 1% chance a year of developing chronic lymphatic leukemia, which is easily treated. So, you know, I'm 70, 71, so it's not a big deal. But I mean, it's like when you talk, there are people who've come to our panel meetings who, there's a guy I can think of who was given a 5-year survival rate of 31, and he was very upset about this. You know, the guy, I mean, was looking towards being 36. Yeah. But it's that initial consultation, and also things that we've discussed before about the cancer journey is that people need to have guidance all the way along the journey. One thing that often happens is it's great at the beginning. You have your radiotherapy, you go home, and there's no actual follow-up or what do I look for? You know, I think I said in one of the examples of really good practice, my uncle, who was 85, he had lymphoma. I took him every day for a month to have his radiotherapy. At the last appointment, they sat him down for half an hour, etc. But some people just drop off, don't they? And they don't have any means of coming back. So it's a matter of having, I don't know, it's having a champion or somebody. I agree with you. It's something that we need to address, you know, for all people who suffer with cancers, things that help them along the way with their journey.
And like currently with this system in GP surgeries, for example, we have our GPs, but we now have our practitioners, so pharmacists, independent prescribers, nurse, independent prescribers. And, you know, a lot of the times you get appointment with them instead of your GP. So I guess previously how you'd have that, you know, relationship with your GP who you'd see at every single appointment, that's not the case now because of obviously the increasing burden on the NHS and with the increasing needs of people. So, you know, how would you say we can overcome that particular issue, especially with people who are so used to, you know, having this GP following their entire journey, and now suddenly they're having to see a number of different healthcare professionals within the GP setting, and they have, for example, a diagnosis of cancer, and they really want for them to be seen by one particular healthcare professional who understands their needs completely as a whole person, not just, you know, the medical needs, but the cultural needs, the social needs, etc. How would you overcome that kind of barrier again, or challenge, I would say?
With great difficulty. One of the other things I do is, you know, is I'm chairman of our local patient participation group. And over the last 2 or 3 years, it's called signposting. It's very, very difficult for patients to not see a doctor. But unfortunately, this is the way forward. But I mean, it's basically we're us talking to practices at some point to find out in what way they think we can actually get the results that we want. And it may not be a doctor, it may be a nurse, it may be a pharmacist. It doesn't really matter as long as there is a contact point in that practice for the patient.
So, like you mentioned, obviously, there are changes to the way we work now, and that is related to the changes in disease prevalence in our community, the chronic diseases being quite prevalent now. And that's why, you know, as long as there's somebody to give the news, like you said, it is okay because you have that point of contact within your communities. However, you know, don't you feel that for cancer patients in particular, it would be more beneficial for them to have that continued contact with their GP, especially, you know, those people from within the ethnic minorities where there's already that language barrier. And so, you know, if they have constantly training healthcare professionals, consulting them at their different appointments, it can be quite difficult for them based on, for example, their understanding of their care or the way they connect with that person who's providing the care.
I think you're right, but I'm not sure how easy that's going to be to change. I mean, it was great for me. I had 5,000 patients and I knew them all. But it's very difficult in modern practices to do that for a lot of reasons. A lot of doctors don't work full-time anymore. I went to a practice and I spent the rest of my life there. That doesn't happen. People move around. And it may be, it may be that we have to look in the future at perhaps training a healthcare professional. I mean, healthcare professionals now do bloods and things like that. It doesn't necessarily have to be somebody who answers all the questions, but it's somebody who can guide them in the right way or be a link or be, you know, goes back to a champion, you know, healthcare champion, somebody who can relate to. And also, I think it would be much better if we can get people who've gone through the experience in the practice. You don't have to be a healthcare professional. You know, if you've gone through the whole system and you've had breast cancer and the treatment and the rest of it, then you're in the best position to tell somebody what the journey is going to be like, better than me. I mean, it would work very well. Whether we can do that in the long term, I don't know. But these are the sorts of things that I think basically medicine has changed now, and there's going to be a lot more emphasis on it. And I think I've said this on several occasions, we've stored up some real problems for ourselves because of COVID. Mm. Because of COVID, what's happened is that there is going to be a real backlog of cancer treatment.
Yeah.
We're going to have a lot of people who I think are going to be very, very unhappy, because it may well be that basically had they engaged with the system and got treatment 6 months earlier, it would have made a difference. Mm-hmm. An example, my friend is a GP, and he said to me the other day that in the last 3 months, he found more men with abnormal PSAs, that sign of prostate cancer, than the previous year. So that's all been stored up. So the survival rate, 5-year survival rate, is going to come down, and we're going to be dealing with this and more people. And it's going to be very difficult to say to somebody, you know, I'm really sorry, but because of COVID, the NHS, your diagnosis has been delayed.
And especially with like the groups that are more disproportionately affected, like with prostate cancer, we know that black men are at twice the risk of prostate cancer. So at the end of the day, you know, those groups are going to be more severely affected, especially with, you know, COVID coming in and contributing to those delays and that entire backlog as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's evident, isn't it? I mean, one of the things that we like to advocate is that the 5 and 10 year survival rate is just doubling, you know, through all the research and the hard work and that the NHS has done. And because of the last 18 months, it's going to fall off quite drastically, I think. And as you've just said yourselves, it's going to be quite a target to do. But I do think there's got to be some form of recruitment within each minority community. And there has to be people that are willing to come forward or are even healthcare professionals that could work within the communities. It's just we need to find a way of finding those people and bringing them forward.
But perhaps we could, I mean, it's a long shot, but perhaps there are more retired GPs like myself out there who may be useful, or maybe, you know, we need to go forward. I mean, we as a group, and decide what we think is the best way of approaching it. And I think it is
difficult. Absolutely.
And I think it would be, you know, I don't know if the GPs would be interested, but I would be interested in trying to recruit them.
Yeah, like you said,
cancer patients. We like a long shot. We like the risky odds. So we're happy to take those odds and move them forward. I know you are, Azzy.
And like you said, retired GPs or having patients who've gone through that experience themselves, and then the idea of champions for ethnic minorities, they're all great ways to start that movement of, you know, improving that relationship between doctors and the ethnic minorities, so that we're able to eventually tackle those cancer inequalities that we currently see affecting them. And, you know, just to wrap things up, is there a final message that you'd like to give out to our listeners today, especially maybe people from the ethnic minority community, from the perspective of a GP and now a patient who's been diagnosed with cancer as well?
My message would be that doctors are approachable, and basically, you know, you need to get in touch with them. You need to have faith in them. Doctors are there to help you and you know, guide you along the path, which may be difficult. And also to realise that if you're a good, caring doctor, you know, mm-hmm. your illness affects them. I mean, I know from my own experience, it was, you know, I think the day when if you're a doctor, when people don't affect you and they have cancer, is the time. You know, I don't mean to break down in tears every time, but it has to have an effect on it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, you can't respond to it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Stuart. It was a pleasure talking to you and hearing your experiences from a number of different perspectives. I think we learned quite a lot. Would you agree, Rob?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure.
This podcast is brought to you by the West Yorkshire and Harrogate Cancer Alliance and patient-led charity, the Yorkshire Cancer Community. To find out more, visit us on our website. That's www.yorkshirecancercommunity.co.uk/cancersmile. Thank you.